It's good to be with you on this beautiful Lord's Day evening. If you have a Bible, please turn open to Mark chapter 16. We'll be reading there in just a moment, Mark chapter 16. If you're visiting with us, we want to make you feel welcome at the Monte Vista Church of Christ and invite you back anytime that you have the opportunity. Mark chapter 16, we'll be reading there in just a moment. This picture on the board here is the burial place of my grandparents, my grandpa and grandma Greeley. Where I took this picture, I'm standing pretty much at the headstone and looking off kind of to the northwest. Cemeteries are really serene places, aren't they? They're really calm. We live in a dry climate. It's very green there. Not loud places. Places that, you know, you come to think. Calm places. Well, can you imagine coming to a place like this and there being sheer panic? You ever heard of tomb raiding or grave raiding? It's where people break into graves or they break into tombs to snatch artifacts, or they break into tombs to snatch jewelry, personal effects that people may have been buried with or whatever. There's another name for actually stealing the body, and it's not a very creative name. It's called body snatching. You snatch the body. And it's sick, isn't it? It's sick that somebody would go to those lengths to get artifacts, to get jewelry, and body snatching is particularly sick. Well, can you imagine the horror, the shock, the amazement, call it whatever you want to call it, if, say, my parents went to this gravesite, or my uncle or my aunts, and they saw that the grave of my grandparents had been broken into, and they thought that their bodies were literally snatched, that their tombs or coffins were broken into. Can you imagine how sad and upset they would be? Well, such is the scene that Lord's Day morning when those few women went to the tomb of Jesus, and at first, that's what they thought, that there had been a body snatching. They were not expecting a resurrection. As the Gospel of Mark will tell us, they had spices in their hand. They plan on anointing the body of Jesus, paying their final respects, and that's going to be that. Begin reading with me in Mark chapter 16, verses 1 through 4. When the Sabbath was passed, Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of James, and Salome brought spices so that they might go and anoint him. Very early, on the first day of the week, when the sun had risen, they went to the tomb, and they were saying to one another, "Who will roll away the stone for us from the entrance of the tomb?" And looking up, they saw that the stone had been rolled back. It was very large. A couple of key things indicate to us that they have zero hope that Jesus is going to be alive. Number one, the bringing of the spices. Number two, their thinking is, who's going to even roll away this stone? There's no thought of, well, perhaps he's going to rise. He said something about resurrection. There's a chance, you know, he might be alive. They plan on giving their final respects, anointing the body of Jesus, and that's going to be that. And there's pure panic. I want to talk with you this evening about whether the grave was robbed, a grave robbed, or the dead risen. I don't have to tell you this, but I'm convinced that the dead did rise, that the literal body of Jesus came alive. Neither did the apostles think that Jesus was going to rise from the dead, because had they known that Jesus was going to rise from the dead, had they been confident about that, they would have obeyed Jesus in meeting him in Galilee. Turn back a couple of chapters, if you will, to chapter 14 and read verse 28. Chapter 14, verse 28, Jesus says very explicitly, "But after I am raised up, where do you meet me? Meet me there in Galilee. I will go before you to Galilee." So had the apostles understood that Jesus was going to be raised, they would have obeyed the direction of Jesus, going to Galilee. And the angel that Mary Magdalene will speak to in just a moment in chapter 16 says, you need to tell the disciples to go to Galilee because that's where the Lord Jesus will meet you. Well, a lot more happens than what Mark says here in Mark chapter 16. You don't actually realize that they think that the body of Jesus has been snatched and laid somewhere else unless you read the Gospel of Mark. I want you to throw a marker there in Mark chapter 16 because we'll come back to it. And turn over with me to John chapter 20. The Gospel of John to chapter 20. And read with me verse 2. John chapter 20, verse 2. The details that John gives us is Mary Magdalene and her companions, they come to the grave, they see that the tomb has been disturbed, and they immediately go tell Peter and John that the grave is empty, without talking to an angel. Well, they tell Peter and John, look at verse 2, she ran in and went to tell Simon Peter and the other disciple, the one whom Jesus loved, and said, they have taken the Lord out of the tomb, and we do not know where they have laid him. You see what her thought process is? Somebody took Jesus. Her thought process isn't Jesus up and walked out by his own power. Her thought process is he was snatched. There's been a body snatching. And the other clue is we don't know where they laid him. She still thinks Jesus is horizontal, not vertical, walking his own 2 feet. And even when she talks to the angel, drop down to verse 13 of chapter 20. They said to her, that meaning the angels, said to Mary Magdalene, this is after Peter and John had run to the tomb, they found it empty just as Mary did. They've now left, and now this interaction with the angels happens. Verse 13, woman, why are you weeping? She said to them, they have taken away my Lord, and I do not know where they have laid him. She's still thinking Jesus is horizontal. And again, can you imagine the panic, the amazement? And just as a side note, I think Mark does a very good job of indicating the emotions of this scene. In chapter 16, verse 5, flip back there, if you will, to Mark chapter 16. Verse 5, it says that they were alarmed. Verse 6 talks about the angel telling the women, do not be alarmed. They went out and fled. There's panic. There's trembling, verse 8. Astonishment had seized them, verse 8. And finally, they were afraid. Well, who wouldn't be? Now begin reading in verse 5. So to help your timeline, just very quickly, between verse 4 and 5 is where I think John's account happened. So they come, they find it empty, they go tell Peter and John. Peter and John ran, they find it empty, they've now left, and now Mary has this conversation with the angel. Verse 5, and entering the tomb, they saw a young man sitting on the right side, dressed in a white robe, and they were alarmed. He said to them, do not be alarmed. You seek Jesus of Nazareth, who was crucified. He has risen. He is not here. See the place where they laid him. But go tell his disciples and Peter that he is going before you to Galilee. That's what we read in chapter 14. There you will see him just as he told you. Verse 8. And they went out, fled from the tomb, for trembling and astonishment had seized them. And they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid. So the angel calms them down immediately. He says, don't worry, I know who you're seeking. You're seeking Jesus of Nazareth, who was crucified. See the place where he laid. I think that the angel might have been pointing not only to the fact that he was gone, but also to the fact that the tomb was nice, neat, and tidy. Do you remember one of the details that John's account gives us of the tomb? Where was the linen cloth? It was folded up, nice, neat, and tidy where he had been laid. This is not evidence of a body snatching where there's panic and people are hurrying and maybe linen cloths are flying everywhere. This is more evidence of this man rising from the dead and saying, I don't need these anymore. I don't need these grave clothes, these grave cloths anymore. See where he has been laid. And then the angel gives Mary Magdalene the duty. Go tell his disciples and go tell Peter. He's going to meet you in Galilee. And this is where the evidence starts to mount, I think. Look at verse 9. Chapter 16, verse 9. Now when he rose early on the first day of the week, he appeared first to Mary Magdalene, from whom he had cast out 7 demons. It is consistent. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John all indicate that the first person to see the resurrected Lord was Mary Magdalene. This is something that a lot of believing scholars have picked up on as something that indicates the brutal honesty of the writers and not the fact that they are pulling a fraud on the people of the first century. And that is because of this. She's a woman. And the testimony of women in that particular time was not looked at as being in high esteem. In fact, most court of laws did not deem a woman's testimony admissible in their courts. So what these believing scholars have said is, and I'll just read you one of them. This man's name is James Holding. He says this: if Christianity wanted to succeed, it should have never admitted that women were the first to discover the empty tomb or to see the risen Jesus first. Nor should it have admitted that women were some of the main supporters. And James Holding's point is, if Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are pulling a massive fraud on first century people, why would they all collectively choose Mary Magdalene, whose testimony would not have been held in high esteem? And I would use that line of logic for one more thing. Did you notice the end of verse 9? It tells you something about the history of Mary Magdalene. She had not been the most mentally stable woman. She had 7 demons at one time. So using this logic of James Holding, why would the writers use the first witness being a woman whose testimony would not be held in high esteem, and then why would they choose a woman who was not exactly the most mentally stable throughout her life? Now, I don't think that that's all the evidence that's in the text. Surely I don't. But I think that it points to the brutal honesty of the writers rather than the fact that they are trying to pull on a massive fraud. Now, I'm going to leave the evidence for now, and I'm going to come back to it later. But something else begins to mount. 3 times, and I'll put up these references here, and you'll read them with me, I'm sure. 3 times the Gospel of Mark will indicate the unbelief on the part of the apostles. Begin reading with me in verse 10. She went, that is Mary Magdalene, she went and told those who had been with him as they mourned and wept. But when they heard that he was alive and had been seen by her, and now note, I want you to underline this last part of verse 11. They would not believe her. They would not believe her. And by the way, Mary Magdalene is not going to the disciples and saying, I found an empty tomb. I don't know what to make of it. And she's not saying, well, I saw an angel who said that he was resurrected. Did you notice what the text specifically says? He had been seen by her. This is eyewitness testimony. I want you to stow that in the back of your mind because we're going to come back to that in just a moment. This is eyewitness testimony. And by the way, this is not eyewitness testimony of a random stranger who said, I saw a vision of this Jesus whom you used to follow. This is Mary Magdalene, very close companion of these 12 disciples, of these 12 apostles. Begin reading with me in verse 12. After these things, he appeared in another form to 2 of them as they were walking into the country. Verse 13, they went back and told the rest, but now note, they did not believe them either. These 2 people are not strangers either. These are 3 close, credible companions who have seen the resurrected Lord. They haven't just seen an empty tomb, but they've seen the body of Jesus. Did you notice in Mark's account it says that they would not believe her in the first one, and then it says that they did not? I don't know if I'm making too much of that, but it seems like the first time that they hear about it, they're like, we just will not believe that, and the second time they just didn't. I wonder if there's a little something going on in their minds, like, I wonder if he could have been. I wonder if he is alive. For the sake of an argument later on in the sermon, I want you to see the 5 times that Jesus predicted that he would rise from the dead. Go back to Mark chapter 8. I'm not doing this survey of predictions just for factual reasons. I don't like to do that in any of my sermons, really. I'm going to build an argument here. I'm going to give you these predictions, and it's going to be a key thing in one of our points later on. But in Mark chapter 8, read verse 31. He began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things, be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes, and be killed, and after 3 days, rise again. Jump over to chapter 9, if you will. This is just after the Mount of Transfiguration. He is with only Peter, James, and John on this particular occasion. And in verse 9 of chapter 9, it says, as they were coming down the mountain,
He charged them to tell no one what they had seen until the Son of Man had been risen from the dead. And by the way, this term Son of Man, this is not a term that would have caused the disciples to scratch their head. You know, this is after the incident where Jesus asked his apostles, who do people say that I, the Son of Man, am? So this Son of Man term is not a confusing term to these disciples. They know exactly who the Son of Man is. And Jesus says, don't tell about this transfiguration until I'm raised up. Jump over to chapter 9 still, and verse 31. He was teaching his disciples, saying to them, the Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men. They will kill him, and when he is killed, after 3 days he will rise. Chapter 10, please. Chapter 10 is rather explicit in its detail. You know how we make fun of palm readers and people who guess things and make predictions based off astrology, you know, and say, in the next few years, a great job opening is going to come open. And it's so general, you know. It's so broad that anybody could have made that prediction. But listen to the explicit detail that Jesus gives here in Mark chapter 10, verse 33. See, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and the scribes. They will condemn him to death, deliver him over to the Gentiles, which is very specific because guess how Jews put people to death? By stoning. Gentiles put people to death by crucifixion. That's very specific. He's going to get delivered over to the Gentiles. Verse 34, they will mock him, spit on him, flog him, kill him, and after 3 days he will rise. I mean, he gets right down to the nitty-gritty, right down to the spitting. And then lastly, we already read it. It's Mark 14 and verse 28. After I am raised up, I will go before you into Galilee. Five predictions, okay? Three eyewitnesses, getting back to Mark 16. Three eyewitnesses that you are companions with. You would think that the disciples would start to think, okay, we need to get to Galilee. He told us that. And it should come as no surprise that what Jesus first does with these disciples when he first sees them is he lays into them. You knuckleheads. Look at verse 14 of chapter 16. Afterward, he appeared to the 11 themselves as they were reclining at table, and he rebuked them. You know, you can imagine these guys being so happy to see Jesus, and Jesus rebukes them first thing. It's like he's meeting them with a rebuke. He rebuked them for their unbelief and hardness of heart, because they did not believe those who saw him after he had been risen. Now here's why I gave you the survey of the predictions. And if you haven't been listening to this sermon, here's where the application point really begins. I am convinced more than ever, I have said this from the pulpit at times, that sometimes we hear what we want to hear. That's wrong. And I'm changing my stance on that. That's all the time. All the time. We hear exactly what we want to hear. How can these apostles be so dull and so thick to have five predictions, three eyewitnesses that are your companions, and it's not sinking in? And it goes back to hearing what you want to hear. Jesus said, we're going to Jerusalem. Bad things are going to happen to me. They're going to spit on me. They're going to reject me. And they didn't want to hear that. They're going to flog me. I'm going to get delivered over to the Gentiles, which I'm sure they understood to be crucifixion. And they did not want to hear that. And by the time Jesus gets to the resurrection part, they've already turned off their listening devices. Which, by the way, is not our ears. I'm sure you've discussed this in your Revelation class. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. It's a spiritual ear. Beloved, 99% of division in the religious world does not come from people intentionally trying to deceive. It comes from people wanting to hear what they want to hear. And brethren, I'm not coming down on religious division and the denominational world. I'm coming down on the Church of Christ. Because these are disciples. And sometimes we hear No, not sometimes. Members of the Church of Christ, we just hear what we want to hear. I just said something to the elders in the elders' room that I'll share with you now. I'm blown away by how much Christians need to be taught after decades of being in the church. You hear about people who change their stance on divorce and remarriage because coincidentally someone in their family is in that situation. Well, isn't that convenient? And you know what's going on? We're hearing what we want to hear. Somebody dies in our family. We want to believe that they're okay. We're hearing what we want to hear, brethren. And I encourage you from the bottom of my heart, turn up the listening device. Take out the filter. Let's listen to everything God says as He said it. The second thing that's important about this verse 14 is this. Jesus expects us to believe eyewitness testimony. Go back to verse 14, if you will. Chapter 16, verse 14. He rebuked them for their unbelief and hardness of heart. Last part. Because they had not believed those who had seen Him. You know, Jesus could have said, I'm rebuking you guys because you didn't believe the Old Testament. He could have said it that way. The Old Testament gave hints about the Messiah not undergoing decay. And Peter actually mentions that on the day of Pentecost. He could have said, you guys are so hard-hearted because you didn't listen to my predictions. He could have said that. But he hones in on the eyewitness portion of it. You didn't believe the credible eyewitness testimony. And it goes to show what I've got there on the title, that Jesus expects us to believe eyewitness testimony. Beloved, what we believe, it's rather strange, isn't it? Here's to stop and think about, you know, everything that we do and say and believe and how we worship, it's all predicated on the fact that a dead man came alive. It's radical. From a human standpoint, I would actually make the point that if you come from the standpoint that there is a God who created all things and that He's all powerful, that the dead being raised is not incredible. Remember what Paul said in Acts chapter 26 and verse 8? He said to that audience, why do you think it's incredible that God should raise the dead? Why do you think that's incredible? Why is that blowing your mind? Paul said. But you know where Paul's coming from is he's coming from the standpoint of a creator, an all-powerful being who surely could raise the dead. But from a human standpoint, yes, it's radical. I get it. It's out there. It's weird. But we have the same evidence that from a human standpoint will send a man to the death row, don't we? We have the same evidence that from a human standpoint, people spend life in prison. Eyewitness accounts. And it shouldn't surprise us how many times the Bible reiterates this. Let me just go through a few. In John 20 and verse 30, remember when John said that many, many miracles, many other signs did Jesus do in the presence of His disciples. Notice, in the presence is noted by John. In John 21 and verse 14, the third time, this is the event where they come to the beach, Jesus has some fish there cooking for breakfast, and He says this is the third time that He was revealed to His disciples physically. And by the way, just another parenthetical statement. Jesus eating fish? Spirits don't eat fish. Literal bodies do. Human beings do. The literal bodily resurrection is what we need to believe in. Acts chapter 1 and verse 8, right before Jesus ascends into heaven, He says to His apostles, you will be my witnesses to Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and to the remotest parts of the earth. But notice He chose that word, witnesses. He didn't say you'll be my preachers, evangelists, teachers. Although all of that would have been true, isn't it interesting that he uses this word? In Acts chapter 2 and verse 32, Peter says that God raised up Jesus, and of this we are all witnesses. Acts 10 verse 40 and 41, at the house of Cornelius, God raised Him on the third day, He said, and he made him to appear. 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verses 5, 6, 7, and 8. He uses the term appeared four times. He appeared to Cephas. He appeared to more than 500 brethren at one time. He appeared to James. And as one untimely born, he appeared also to me. And lastly, 1 John 1, 2, and 3. We have seen with our eyes, we have seen it, which we have seen. Those are in verse 1, 2, and 3. Why is the Bible so adamant about making a point of saying people saw this? It's enough evidence. It's enough. I will never forget a conversation I had with one of my fellow Marines on a deployment. I was working the night shift, and you get done with your work, and then you have 2 hours of debating with each other, you know, until your shift was over. And this guy, Sergeant Garcia, adamant atheist, and he really honed in on me because he knew I could take it. He knew I could defend myself to some degree. And he asked me one night, he said, "Do you really believe all that? Can you really believe that, Alan? You're a reasonable guy, that a dead man rose from the dead and ascended into heaven, never going to die anymore?" And I gave him the answer that I will give any person, brethren, unbelievers, atheists, I don't care who it is. Yes, I do believe, because people saw. Credible witnesses saw. And this isn't a subjective vision that one person has. Hundreds of people saw, and hundreds of people went to their death for what they saw. And until you can discredit the eyewitnesses, what I've got for evidence is much stronger than what you got, as bizarre as it is. As bizarre as it is. And lastly, you ever thought about it like this? The evidence is so strong in the mind of God, He will condemn us all if we don't believe. You know, Acts chapter 17, Paul says that the evidence that there is a judgment is the fact that he raised up Jesus. He has declared to all men everywhere that they should repent, because he has fixed a day in which he will judge the world in righteousness. And having furnished proof of this by raising him from the dead, God gave us proof that there's a judgment day by raising Jesus from the dead. So God thinks that it's strong enough. But you say, "Alan, that doesn't necessarily talk about condemning, though. That just talks about that there is a judgment." And that leads me to my last two verses of the Gospel of Mark. I promise I'll never preach from the Gospel of Mark ever again. This is it. I'm done. If you've been following the radio program, I promise. Verse 15 and 16. He said to them, "Go into all the world, proclaim the gospel to the whole creation." Verse 16. "Whoever believes and is baptized will be saved." Now, we normally just focus on the first part, because we're trying to convince people of the necessity of baptism. And that first part is there. Jesus said, you got to believe and you got to be baptized, and that person will be saved. But I want to focus on the last part. "He that does not believe will be condemned." You mean to tell me, Alan, that if I don't believe in the gospel, that I'm going to be condemned? That's exactly what I'm saying. But actually, I didn't say it. The man who came alive did. And if I'm going to trust anybody, it's somebody who's coming back from the dead. But you put it in this greater context of Mark 16. And what's the story telling? About the literal bodily resurrection. And after that, just after that, of rebuking the disciples for not believing the eyewitnesses, he tells them that if you don't believe, you're going to be condemned. Wow. Let's think seriously about what we believe. More than ever, people who say they believe in Jesus are abandoning the literal miracles, the literal bodily resurrection. And if I had to guess, in the next 15 to 20 years, the Church of Christ will follow suit just like it always does, and it'll be an issue. Please get out your songbooks and turn to the Song of Invitation. I just mentioned that Jesus expects us to believe off eyewitness testimonies, but you see Mark 16:16, I'll actually have to change that. Jesus demands it. He demands that we believe. If we believe that these are credible eyewitnesses, and I most certainly do, the hope of our resurrection is based on His. Remember that cemetery I showed you at the beginning? All those people will rise, including family, on that great day. And I'm looking forward to seeing family, but more than that, I'm looking forward to seeing the Lord Jesus. Maranatha, Lord, come quickly. The waters of baptism are prepared. Please, if you haven't obeyed the gospel, you have that opportunity. Will you come as together we stand and sing?